I'm Michelle Magwood, and this interview is brought to you by Sunday Times Books. The distinguished novelist Ian McEwan has published a new book titled Machines Like Me. It's set in an alternative 1980s London, much of it familiar, some of it not. Charlie is a lethargic, somewhat directionless young man who's making just enough money to get by. He's in love with Miranda, his younger neighbour, who is living with a disturbing secret. When Charlie inherits some money, he buys one of the first synthetic humans, a man named Adam. This is not a straight science fiction or dystopian novel. Instead, it asks us what it means to be human. I spoke to Ian McEwan in London. Machines Like Me is the most extraordinary novel. It's a novel of ideas, Ian. I was absolutely enthralled by your imagining of this world. Will you tell me about the genesis of the novel?
Well, it's one of those novels where I had done all my research without realizing it, sort of over a lifetime. It's been a kind of preoccupation that dates back to maybe the mid to late 70s when I wrote a play for television called The Imitation Game, and I read a great deal about Bletchley, the code-breaking center, which was just then coming out of the Official Secrets Act veil. And I interviewed some various elderly ladies who had worked as young women on the Turing machines there. And that really stimulated a lifelong interest in Turing. Then I remember being sent by a magazine to interview the professor of robotology at Edinburgh University. That would have been 1976. And he, as it turned out, had been one of the central figures at Bletchley, so that all tied together. And then I've got various philosopher friends, and I've been interested in discussions about whether a machine could think or feel. And I've had a long interest in neuroscience, and in the early 90s, when consciousness became a serious subject for neuroscience, I followed that very closely. The last 10 years have seen quite a sort of surge in developments, especially in software. And I met Demis Hassabis, who I mentioned in the acknowledgements, and he and his colleagues devised that program that could beat a grandmaster at Go. Mm. And then they went back to chess and devised a very successful program in which the computer only knew the rules of the game, wasn't doing number crunching, but actually representing a form of general intelligence. So I guess this is a long way of saying it's been on my mind a long time, but I'd never thought of writing a novel about it. And suddenly it was all there.
And why did you choose the 1980s in which to set it rather than another era or even the future?
Well, one thing sort of followed another. I wanted science to be in a different place. I've got very little interest in science fiction as such, set in the remote future or near future, because it always has a vaguely predictive air. And by setting a novel in the past, I feel I sort of was free of that and could just get into a kind of realm of speculation about what it would be like to be closely involved with a highly sophisticated form of artificial human. The first idea was to let Alan Turing live rather than die in 1954. But I didn't want him to be too old, so he was 70, my age. Uh-huh. That brought us to 1982. I was interested in just revisiting the Falklands War and rewriting it, as it were. It was very much a kind of the Iraq of its time, but with a somewhat different outcome, of course. And then I thought, well, if I've changed the science and I've changed the Falklands War, I might as well change the politics and the degree of the social history, really to just underline a sense of how frail a construct, and I say this in the novel, how frail a construct the present is. You know, we know that as the future folds into the present, all kinds of possibilities collapse around us and we go surging down one route. And the present takes on this sort of inevitable air. But we know it could so easily be otherwise. The Industrial Revolution could have happened not in the North Midlands in the 18th century in England, but in some other country, in some other time, or not at all. So, you know, science could be in a different place.
The survival of Alan Turing raises that melancholy question, doesn't it, of what if he and so many other brilliant minds had survived, what could have been achieved?
Yes. I mean, his work in the 30s really laid down the foundations of digital computing, and then that was taken up by von Neumann in the 50s. And had he lived, who knows? I mean, I don't think, honestly, if Turing had lived, we would have had a creature like Adam by 1982, really, seriously. But still, I just like to play with the idea that the terrible circumstances of awful anti-gay laws which drove a man to his suicide, we don't have the full story of his suicide. You know, what things could flow had he lived? And of course we often speculate, you know, what would have happened if Keats had lived longer or Schubert had lived longer or Mozart. I mean, what extraordinary cultural artifacts would be ours? So, you know, seen from the past, especially the remote past, our current present is a really slim possibility. You know, the tiniest, remotest possibilities to bring us this.
Mm.
So it's interesting, I think, for novelists who are in charge of fates to actually play with them themselves. And so this novel really is, as well as wanting to look at the serious implications of artificial intelligence, is also playful about time and the possibilities of changed circumstances.
I love, you have a brilliant mix of, if I can call it, utopian and dystopian things, which are playful. For example, you write of super fast trains that are nevertheless cramped and filthy, and the Manhattan and Ruhr jams that saw the end of the self-driving car.
Well, we have all these wonderful machines, and I always remember reading of a congress of Spanish anarchists in 1895. And a speech in which one of them said, one day, comrades, workers will live in huge towers and they'll have electric light and water will come out of taps in their houses. Well, all that came true, but these huge towers are, you know, often hellish. So the future arrives, the marvelous machines are among us, the fabulous construct of the internet happens, the amazing smartphones as extensions of our brains are in our pockets and in our hands, and they drag with them new problems, new squalor, new difficulties. You know, we devise our future in a sense, but we're never in control of it. So it's a fascinating problem how quickly, as I say at the beginning, these amazing machines arrive and then they just become commonplace. So the trains could be rushing across the landscape at 300 miles an hour, but, you know, you're sitting near a pool of vomit. So, you know, not so long ago, in the time of our great-great-grandfathers, when the train was first becoming widespread, It was astonishing to be hurtling along at 30 miles an hour. People even wondered if you were in the open air, in open carriages, whether you could breathe. Then these things become commonplace, just as the extraordinary horseless carriage did, and brought with it a whole new set of problems. So the future never quite delivers, or it over-delivers, or it is, or it just becomes ordinary to us at such rapid speed now. And that's why I have that list of, you know, frivolous list of discarded items. You know, the fondue sets of the 60s. Where are they now?
One of the most intriguing ideas that you introduce is that literature would become redundant. Would you expand on that?
Well, this is Adam's idea, and this is part of Adam's kind of adolescent exuberance as his learning programs kick off. And of course, he poses it as a utopia, that if we had implants in our brains that gave us access not only instantly to the internet, but to each other, and that everybody understood each other, and a privacy would be abolished, and so would all misunderstandings, literature would collapse, because the novel especially is built around things going wrong. You know, we leave it to lyric poetry to celebrate the beauty of things going well between lovers, but the novel loves to investigate what goes wrong between lovers, or when love turns to indifference or boredom or even hatred or disloyalty, jealousies, and so on. Our bookshelves are just stuffed full of meditations on what can happen between lovers. And of course, the narrator and his lover, Miranda, instantly feel that this is not a utopia, or it's a utopian dream that hides, like all utopian dreams, a nightmare. So no, I don't think we'll ever get to such things, but it was part of Adam's exuberance to unfold it.
I'd say that all of your novels are an extended investigation of moral issues, but this one goes even deeper. It goes down to the very meaning of being human, doesn't it?
Well, fortunately, the subject throws it back at us in a way that's unavoidable. If we begin to define what it is, if we're going to ask ourselves, is this artificial human fully conscious like we are, it pushes us to say, well, what does it mean to be fully conscious? How do we define its limits? And what does it mean to say of someone that they have feelings or that they can love? So, yes, it will. The demands on us are going to be, we're going to have to ask ourselves some very important questions, and it's already happening. We are, for example, about to confront the whole new technology, which will soon become very boring, of autonomous vehicles. And we're already having to decide what such a vehicle is going to do faced with a crash. You know, who does it prioritize, the driver or some innocent pedestrian?
Mm-hmm.
And we now already know that manufacturers are having to devise programs that address simply that moral problem. And we are already handing over moral, ethical decisions to computer software. I don't know if you saw it, but there was a very big study carried in Nature a while ago, about 6 months ago, of it surveyed about 1.5 million respondents on who are the most valuable human beings. Now, Europeans and Americans all were pretty strong on the idea that children were the humans whose lives you would value most. Interestingly, the Chinese results were different. They valued old people above children. So that throws us back on some notion, well, we don't have necessarily universal values of who who we esteem or consider most precious. So that raises problems for car manufacturers. When they get their autonomous vehicles on the road, they might have to tweak it slightly differently in Europe than from China. So already we're in a world not really, I mean, the technological considerations are very interesting, but by far the more interesting matter is what it means to live alongside artificial intelligence and delegate moral decision-making to a machine, even before we've got a sort of humanoid. You know, we're talking here of banks of computers and laptops thinking our moral problems through for us. This is a big step, you know, and we're already making it.
I did read Noah Yuval Harari's book, you know, Lessons for the 21st Century. I don't know whether you've read that. And
I haven't read it, but I know of it.
And it is quite chilling regarding algorithms and data. And when you combine those with humans, it is really quite scary.
Yeah, I mean, it's both scary and exhilarating all at once. And it really is going to unwrap a whole set of problems which we're only just beginning to see. And I think a parallel, I mean, it's useful to consider, if you go back to the late 90s, not so long ago in my lifetime, feels, when the internet was becoming general, everyone was going onto it, we had no idea what the consequences of it would be. People first said, well, it's going to have extraordinary consequences for overthrowing dictatorships and, you know, played an important part in citizen journalism. And it all felt quite positive. But the effects and interface between the internet, social media, and nationalistic populism was never anticipated, even though all the technology was there for it. And the unfolding is, you know, so unexpected. All the wisebeards constantly predicting for us in newspaper items about what's going to happen with this or that. Generally, everybody is wrong. I mean, we make this future, but we're just not in control of it. And all that I find utterly fascinating. And I think this will be a great opportunity for novelists, actually. And it needs to be lifted out of the realm of science fiction. We need to actually get deep into the moral and emotional connections we are going to make with artificial intelligences. And that's really the heart of this novel, because at its center is a moral problem about rape and revenge and how a well-programmed machine full of some of our best moral precepts might disagree profoundly with us. And we're very good at knowing what's good. We have religions and philosophies and even gossip over the garden fence to demonstrate that we know how to be good, but we can't always behave well. Now, we might make machines that we can stuff full of our best moral precepts, and then they find themselves very uncomfortable in our worlds. So if we don't know ourselves very well, we might be ill-suited to play the role of God in making these machines. And I think novelists should have a field day with this, because it's really got to be unwrapped at the personal level.
It does. It's up to the novelist, I think, you know, the imagining of it. I think it's very hard to get a clear view of something when you're living through it. And you almost wish that you could look back in 10 years' time and say that was what was happening.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and when you say living through it, you imply there's an end, but of course there's not. There's just endless developments. So we're always living through it. That's the point. We never get to any safe perch because new technologies will come along to merge with the ones we already have. And our very own. Well, this is my prediction anyway. I think as we make this slow adjustment to AI in our lives, our own moral perspectives will slowly shift. And there could come a time when if we built completely humanoid robots like Adam, that we would begin to accept them. Because we already have such a strong disposition to anthropomorphize anyway. We already have, when your car breaks down and you give it a good kick, you are in an emotional relationship with a machine.
Yes.
You're kind of helplessly ascribing to it some bad intentions for which it needs to be punished. That's deep within us. So I think we'll be projecting consciousness onto these machines even before they have it. And already we know from Japan, where there are lots of, you know, little dog-like robots that remind very old people when to take their pills and so on, these old people get amazingly attached to these devices. And I think it's within us all. Probably, you know, it's one of the mainsprings of how religions develop, to kind of anthropomorphize the natural world, whether it's thunder and lightning or storms or the return of spring. We're natural projectors of human motives onto the world around us. So it's going to be interesting. It's going to be very interesting. And I think it's going to be very bumpy. And yet, I think, as we said right at the beginning of this conversation, it's going to really bring us up in front of a sort of mirror as to our own nature.
And do you fear for this world, for your grandchildren?
Yes, I fear for it. My grandchildren have yet to encounter the world of social media. Their parents are pretty good at keeping them away even from TV screens and just filling them with books and, you know, imaginative games. But soon that will end. That's the kind of Eden they're in. And when they're 9 years or 13 years old, they'll be surrounded by friends who watch a lot of TV and who are in touch with each other on, you know, WhatsApp or whatever, Instagram. And they won't be able to afford to not be in it. And those worlds already, and this is existing technology, already create, I think, a lot of anxiety for children, where they are in pecking orders, are they popular, and so on. A real burden for them. So I fear for that. And I love to witness their wonderful mental freedom at the moment. I think they watch maybe a movie at Christmas on the television, and the very, very occasional movie elsewhere, cartoon. But they're still in a world of such delightful interactions with their own imaginations and the natural world and living creatures. So projecting that forward, to their grandchildren, there's just no telling where we're going to end up. Well, we're not going to end up. We're just going to keep going,
yes.
I hope. But, you know, what lies ahead of us? So I have real concerns about that, but they're also going to be, I hope, extraordinary opportunities discovering, for example, whether intelligence has a limit for humans.
If I could ask you one last question, I was,
and
I know that you are a strongly atheist man, and I was looking forward to seeing how religion would play out in this queered world, and by queered I mean the strange world of that you've created in the 1980s, and it didn't loom as large as I thought it might.
No, I thought I'd give religion a miss. Really, I think there's a much more fundamental problem here, which is that of this group of 25 robots, Many of them are switching their consciousnesses off. They've arrived in this world with many good intentions and good moral precepts, but then they find extraordinary paradoxes of that children are dying of easily curable diseases, that we love nature but we destroy it at the same time, that women are treated in some places far more harshly with far more restricted possibilities of consciousness than men, and they can't take it anymore. And in a way, I think that's a kind of spiritual revolt. And to come back to the notion of being godlike when we make these creatures. And remember, this is a very strong element in our culture that goes back, well, to the beginning of recorded history. The myth of Prometheus, the story of the robot in the Jason and the Argonauts, the robot called Talos. Indeed, the mythic power of the Book of Genesis, making of a man and a woman out of clay, or the woman out of the man. We now have it's within sight, at least, or within sight of the imagination, that we play that role of Prometheus and of the God, Christian God. But we bring to it all our own cognitive defects. So I think, in a sense, I do touch on it without naming it, what it is for us to play God.
Mm. Well, as always, you've given us so much to think about, and this is an astounding book. Ian McEwan, I thank you so much for your time.
Well, real pleasure talking to you.